remain of cheerful or of rational society within their reach. Mr. Knightley to be no longer coming there for his evening comfort, no longer walking in at all hours as if he were ever willing to change his own home for theirs. How was it to be endured? And if he were to be lost to them for Harriet's sake, if Harriet were to be the chosen, the first, the wife to whom he looked for all the best blessings of existence, what could be increasing Emma's wretchedness but the reflection, never far distant from her mind, that it had been all her own work? When it came to such a pitch as this, she was not able to refrain from a start or a heavy sigh or even from walking about the room for a few seconds. Her only small source of consolation was in the resolution of her own better conduct and the hope that as she became more rational, more acquainted with herself, she may have less to regret in future seasons than the present one. In the afternoon, the weather cleared. The wind changed into a softer quarter. The clouds were carried off and the sun appeared. It was summer again. With all the eagerness which such a transition gives, Emma resolved to be out of doors as soon as possible. Never had the exquisite sight, smell, and sensation of nature, tranquil, warm, and brilliant after a storm, been more attractive to her. She longed for the serenity they might gradually introduce, and on Mr. Perry's coming in soon after dinner with a disengaged hour to give her father, she lost no time in hurrying into the shrubbery. There, with spirits freshened and thoughts a little relieved, she had taken a few turns when she saw Mr. Knightley passing through the garden door and coming towards her. It was the first intimation of his being returned from London. She had been thinking of him the moment before as unquestionably 16 miles distant. There was time only for the quickest arrangement of mind. She must be collected and calm. In half a minute, they were together.
Emma, how do you do?
Very well, I thank you. I hope you are well?
Quite well.
And how is everybody at Brunswick Square?
They are all well. Isabella asked me to send her love.
When did you leave them?
Only this morning.
You must have had a wet ride.
Yes. Might I walk with you, Emma? I've just looked into the dining room, but since I'm not needed there, I prefer to be out of doors.
Of course.
They walked together. He was silent. She thought he was often looking at her and trying for a fuller view of her face than it suited her to give. And this belief produced a dread. Perhaps he wanted to speak to her of his attachment to Harriet. He might be watching for encouragement to begin. She did not, could not, feel equal to lead the way to any such subject. He must do it all himself. Yet she could not bear this silence. With him it was most unnatural. She considered, resolved, and, trying to smile, began.
You have some news to hear, now you are come back, that will rather surprise you.
Have I? Of what nature?
Oh, the best nature in the world. A wedding.
If you mean Miss Fairfax and Frank Churchill, I've heard that already.
How is it possible?
I had a few lines on parish business from Mr. Weston this morning, and at the end of them he gave me a brief account of what had happened.
You probably have been less surprised than any of us, for you have had your suspicions. I've not forgotten that you once tried to give me a caution. I wish I had attended to it. But I seem to have been doomed to blindness.
For a moment or two, nothing was said, and she was unsuspicious of having excited any particular interest, till she found her arm drawn within his and pressed against his heart for a moment. She looked at him in surprise and saw a look of real, affectionate concern in his eye. He let her arm go, gently, and he spoke again, quite low, and with a tone of great sensibility.
Time, my dearest Emma, time will heal the wound. Your own excellent sense, your exertions for your father's sake. Frank Churchill is an abominable scoundrel. He will soon be gone. They will soon be in Yorkshire. I'm sorry for her. She deserves a better fate.
You are very kind, but you are mistaken. And I must set you right. I am not in want of that sort of compassion. My blindness to what was going on led me to act by them in a way that I must always be ashamed of. And I was very foolishly tempted to say and do many things which may well lay me open to unpleasant conjectures. But I have no other reason to regret that I was not in the secret earlier.
Emma, are you indeed... No, I understand you. Forgive me. I am pleased that you can say even so much. He is no object of regret, indeed. And it will not be very long, I hope, before that becomes the acknowledgement of more than your reason. Fortunate that your affections were not further entangled. I could never, I confess, from your manners assure myself as to the degree of what you felt. I could only be certain that there was a preference, and a preference which I never believed him to deserve. He is a disgrace to the name of man, and is he to be rewarded with that sweet young woman? Jane, you will be a miserable creature.
Mr. Knightley, I cannot let you continue in your error. And yet, perhaps since my manners gave such an impression, I should be ashamed of confessing the truth of the matter. I never have been at all attached to Frank Churchill. I have very little to say for my own conduct. I was tempted by his attentions and allowed myself to appear pleased. An old story, probably, a common case, and no more than has happened to hundreds of my sex before. He has imposed on me, but he has not injured me. I have never been attached to him. And now I can tolerably comprehend his behaviour. He never wished to attach me. It was merely a blind to conceal his real situation with another. But I was not blinded. It was my good fortune that I was safe from him.
I have never had a high opinion of Frank Churchill. I can suppose, however, that I may have underrated him. I have no motive for wishing him ill, and for Miss Fairfax's sake, whose happiness will be involved in his good character and conduct, I shall certainly wish him well.
I have no doubt of their being happy together. I believe them to be very mutually and very sincerely attached.
He is a most fortunate man. So early in life, a period when, if a man chooses a wife, he generally chooses ill, to have drawn such a prize. What years of felicity that man, in all human calculation, has before him. Frank Churchill is, indeed, the favourite of fortune. Everything turns out for his good. He meets with a young woman at a watering place, gains her affection, cannot even weary her by negligent treatment, and had he and all his family sought round the world for a perfect wife for him, they could not have found her superior. His aunt is in the way. His aunt dies. He had used everybody ill, and they are all delighted to forgive him. He is a fortunate man indeed.
You speak as if you envied him.
I do envy him, Emma. In one respect, he is the object of my envy.
Emma could say no more. They seemed to be within half a sentence of Harriet, and her immediate feeling was to avert the subject if possible. She made her plan. She would speak of something totally different, the children in Brunswick Square, and she only waited for breath to begin when Mr. Knightley startled her by saying...
You will not ask me what is the point of my envy. You are determined, I see, to have no curiosity. You are wise, but I cannot be wise. Emma, I must tell you what you will not ask, though I may wish it unsaid the next moment.
Oh, then don't speak it. Don't speak it. Take a little time. Consider. Do not commit yourself.
Not another syllable followed. Emma could not bear to give him pain. He was wishing to confide in her, perhaps to consult her. Cost her what it would, she would listen. She might assist his resolution. She might give just praise to Harriet, or help relieve him from that state of indecision which must be more intolerable than any alternative to such a mind as his.
I stopped you ungraciously just now, Mr. Knightley, and I am afraid gave you pain. But if you have any wish to speak openly to me as a friend, or to ask my opinion of anything that you may have in contemplation, as a friend, indeed, you may command me. I will hear whatever you like. I will tell you exactly what I think.
As a friend, Emma, that, I fear, is a word. No, I have no wish to... Stay. Yes. Why should I hesitate? I have gone too far already for concealment. Emma, I accept your offer. Extraordinary as it may seem, I accept it and refer myself to you as a friend. I came here only to see how you bore Frank Churchill's engagement, but your total indifference towards him has given me hope that, in time, I may gain your affection myself.
Mr. Knightley paused and turned to Emma in hope of an answer in look or in word. She could say nothing, however, and only held his gaze for a moment before turning away.
Tell me, then, have I no chance of ever succeeding? My dearest Emma, for dearest you will always be, whatever the event of this hour's conversation, my dearest, most beloved Emma, tell me at once. Say no, if it is to be said. You are silent. Absolutely silent. At present, I ask no more.
Emma was almost ready to sink under the agitation of this moment. The dread of being awakened from the happiest dream was perhaps the most prominent feeling.
I cannot make speeches, Emma. If I loved you less, I might be able to talk about it more, but you know what I am. You hear nothing but truth from me.
While he spoke, Emma's mind was most busy, and with all the wonderful velocity of thought, saw that Harriet's hopes had been entirely groundless, a delusion. Harriet was nothing. She was everything, herself. There was time also to rejoice that Harriet's secret had not escaped her, and to resolve that it need not and should not. Emma's silence created a suspense which Mr. Knightley could no longer bear.
Let me speak, then, if you will not. I know that I have blamed you and lectured you, and you have borne it as no other woman in England would have borne it. I hope you can bear with the truths I would tell you now, dearest Emma. God knows I have been a very indifferent lover, but you understand me. Yes, you see, you understand my feelings and will return them if you can. At present, I ask only to hear, once, to hear your voice.
She spoke then, on being so entreated. What did she say? Just what she ought, of course. A lady always does. She said enough to show there need not be despair, and to invite him to say more himself. Mr. Knightley obliged, and detailed his long-standing jealousy, old as the arrival or even the expectation of Frank Churchill.
I have been in love with you, Emma, and jealous of him from about the same period. I believe one sentiment enlightened me as to the other. It was my jealousy of Frank Churchill that took me from the country. The Box Hill party had decided it for me. I would save myself from witnessing again such permitted, encouraged attentions. I had gone to learn to be indifferent, but I had gone to the wrong place. There was too much domestic happiness in my brother's house. Isabella was too much like Emma for much to have been done, even had my time been longer. I stayed on, however, vigorously, day after day, till this very morning's post had conveyed the history of Jane Fairfax. Then, with the gladness which must be felt, nay, which I did not scruple to feel, having never believed Frank Churchill to be at all deserving of you, was there so much fond solicitude, so much keen anxiety for you, that I could stay no longer? I rode home through the rain, and walked up directly after dinner to see how you bore the discovery. You, Emma, the sweetest and best of all creatures, faultless in spite of all your faults.
Mr. Knightley could not speak to a more relenting heart than Emma's, or a heart more disposed to accept of his. He had, in fact, been wholly unsuspicious of his own influence. The affection, which he had been asking to be allowed to create if he could, was already his. Within half an hour, he had passed from a thoroughly distressed state of mind to something so like perfect happiness that it could bear no other name. Her change was equal. This one half hour had given to each the same precious certainty of being beloved. She was his own Emma, by hand and word, when they returned into the house, and if he could have thought of Frank Churchill then, he might have deemed him a very good sort of fellow. They sat down to tea. The same party, round the same table, how often it had been collected, and how often her eyes fallen on the same shrubs in the lawn, and observed the same beautiful effect of the western sun, but never in such a state of spirits, never in anything like it. And it was with difficulty that she could summon enough of her usual self to be the attentive lady of the house, or even the attentive daughter. Poor Mr. Woodhouse little suspected what was plotting against him in the breast of that man whom he was so cordially welcoming, and so anxiously hoping might not have taken cold from his ride. Could he have seen the heart, he would have cared very little for the lungs. As long as Mr. Knightley remained with them, Emma's fever continued, but when he was gone, she began to be a little tranquillized and subdued, and in the course of the sleepless night, which was the tax for such an evening, she found two very serious points to consider. Perhaps even her happiness must have some alloy. The persons she considered were her father and Harriet. With respect to her father, it was a question soon answered. She hardly knew yet what Mr. Knightley would ask, but a very short parley with her own heart produced the most solemn resolution of never quitting her father. She even wept over the idea of it as a sin of thought. While he lived, it must be only an engagement. How to do her best by Harriet was a more difficult decision. How to spare her from any unnecessary pain, how to make her any possible atonement, how to appear least her enemy. On these subjects, her perplexity and distress were very great. She could only resolve at last that she would still avoid a meeting with her and communicate all that need be told by letter. It would be inexpressibly desirable to have her removed just now for a time from Highbury, and indulging in one scheme more, it might be practicable to get an invitation for her to Brunswick Square. Isabella had been pleased with Harriet, and a few weeks spent in London with all the novelty and variety of the streets, the shops, and the children must give her some amusement and benefit. She rose early and wrote her letter to Harriet, an employment which left her so very serious, so nearly sad, that Mr. Knightley, in walking up to Hartfield to breakfast, did not arrive at all too soon. Half an hour stolen afterwards to go over the same ground again with him, literally and figuratively, was quite necessary to reinstate her in a proper share of the happiness of the evening before. He had not left her long when a letter was brought her from Randalls, a very thick letter. She guessed what it must contain, and deprecated the necessity of reading it. She was now in perfect charity with Frank Churchill. She wanted no explanations. She wanted only to have her thoughts to herself. It must be waded through, however. She resolved to do so, and opened the packet. A note from Mrs. Weston to herself ushered in the letter from Frank to Mrs. Weston.
I have the greatest pleasure, my dear Emma, in forwarding to you the enclosed. I know what thorough justice you will do it, and have scarcely a doubt of its happy effect. I think we shall never materially disagree about the writer again. But I will not delay you by a long preface. Yours ever, A.W.
To Mrs. Weston. Windsor, July. My dear madam, I write to seek pardon for some parts of my past conduct from you, and from those among your friends who have had any ground of offence. You must all endeavour to comprehend that when I first arrived at Randall's, I had a secret which was to be kept at all hazards. Before I parted from Miss Fairfax at Weymouth, I was fortunate enough to induce that most upright female to stoop in charity to a secret engagement. My difficulties in the then state of Enscombe must be too well known to require definition, but there lay the reason for secrecy. See me, then, under these circumstances, arriving on my first visit to Randall's, and here I am conscious of wrong, for that visit might have been sooner paid. You will look back and see that I did not come till Miss Fairfax was in Highbury. My behaviour during the very happy fortnight which I spent with you did not, I hope, lay me open to reprehension, excepting on one point. With the greatest respect and the warmest friendship do I mention Miss Woodhouse. My behaviour to her indicated, I believe, more than it ought. In order to assist a concealment so essential to me, I was led on to make more than an allowable use of the sort of intimacy into which we were immediately thrown. I cannot deny that Miss Woodhouse was my ostensible object, but had I not been convinced of her indifference, I would not have been induced by any selfish views to go on. She received my attentions with an easy, friendly, good-humoured playfulness, which exactly suited me. Whether Miss Woodhouse began really to understand me before the expiration of that fortnight, I cannot say. When I called to take leave of her, I remembered that I was within a moment of confessing the truth, and I then fancied she was not without suspicion. I hope this history of my conduct towards her will be admitted by you and my father as a great extenuation of what you saw amiss. Acquit me here, and procure for me, when it is allowable, the acquittal and good wishes of that said Emma Woodhouse, whom I regard with so much brotherly affection as to long to have her as deeply and as happily in love as myself. Whatever strange things I said or did during that fortnight, you now have a key to. My heart was in Highbury, and my business was to get my body thither as often as might be, and with the least suspicion. Of the pianoforte, so much talked of, I feel it only necessary to say that its being ordered was absolutely unknown to Miss Fairfax, who would never have allowed me to send it had any choice been given her. I must still add to this long letter. You have not heard all that you ought to hear. The suddenness, and in one light the unseasonableness, with which the affair burst out needs explanation. I should not have presumed on such early measures, but from the very particular circumstances which left me not an hour to lose. It is a most mortifying retrospect for me. I behaved shamefully. And here I can admit that my manners to Miss Woodhouse, in being unpleasant to Miss Fairfax, were highly blamable. Miss Fairfax was displeased. I thought unreasonably so. I thought her, on a thousand occasions, unnecessarily cautious, even cold. We quarrelled. Do you remember the morning spent at Donwell? There, every little dissatisfaction that had occurred before came to a crisis. I was late. I met her walking home by herself and wanted to walk with her, but she would not suffer it. She absolutely refused to allow me, which I then thought most unreasonable. Now, however, I see that it was only righteous discretion. Had we been met walking together between Donwell and Highbury, the truth must have been suspected. I was mad enough, however, to resent. I doubted her affection. I doubted it more the next day on Box Hill when, provoked by my shameful, insolent neglect of her, and such apparent devotion to Miss Woodhouse as it would have been impossible for any woman of sense to endure, she spoke her resentment in a form of words perfectly intelligible to me. Then, as soon as she found I was really gone from Randall's, she closed with the offer of that officious Mrs. Elton, the whole system of whose treatment of her, by the by, has ever filled me with indignation and hatred. Miss Fairfax resolved to break with me entirely, and wrote the next day, she felt the engagement to be a source of repentance and misery to each. She dissolved it. This letter reached me on the very morning of my poor aunt's death. I answered it within an hour, but I later discovered that my answer, instead of being sent, was locked up in my writing desk. I can only blame the confusion of my mind and the multiplicity of business falling on me at once that day. 2 days afterwards, I received a parcel from Miss Fairfax, my own letters all returned, and a request that I return all of her letters to Highbury within a week, or forward them after that period to her at Mr. Smallridge's, near Bristol. I knew the name, the place, I knew all about it, and instantly saw what she had been doing. Imagine the shock! Imagine how, till I had actually detected my own blunder, I raved at the blunders of the post for mislaying my last, most vital letter to her. I spoke to my uncle immediately. Without his sanction, I could not hope to be listened to by Miss Fairfax again. I spoke. Circumstances were in my favour. The late event had softened away his pride, and he was, earlier than I could have anticipated, wholly reconciled and complying. I reached Highbury and called upon Miss Fairfax at a time when she was likely to be alone. A great deal of very reasonable, very just displeasure I had to persuade away. But it is done. We are reconciled, and dearer, much dearer than ever. A thousand thanks for all the kindness you have ever shown me, and 10,000 for the attentions your heart will dictate towards Miss Fairfax. If you think me in a way to be happier than I deserve, I am quite of your opinion. In one respect, my good fortune is undoubted. That of being able to subscribe myself, your obliged and affectionate son, F.C. Weston Churchill.
This letter must make its way to Emma's feelings. She was obliged, in spite of her previous determination to the contrary, to do it all the justice that Mrs. Weston foretold. She thought so well of the letter that when Mr. Knightley came again, she desired him to read it. She was sure of Mrs. Weston's wishing it to be communicated, especially to one like Mr. Knightley, who had seen so much to blame in his conduct. He read it, speaking his opinion aloud as he did so. When he came to Miss Woodhouse, he was obliged to read the whole of it aloud, all that related to her, with a smile, a look, a shake of the head, a word or two of assent or disapprobation, or merely of love, as the subject required, concluding, however, seriously and after steady reflection, thus.
He has been deceived by his own wishes, and regardless of little besides his own convenience. He has had great faults, faults of inconsideration and thoughtlessness. He is, however, really attached to Miss Fairfax, and will soon, it may be hoped, have the advantage of being constantly with her and acquiring from her the steadiness and delicacy of principle that his character wants. My Emma, does not everything between them serve to prove more and more the beauty of truth and sincerity in all our dealings with each other? And now let me talk to you of something else. I have another person's interest at present so much at heart that I cannot think any longer about Frank Churchill. Ever since I left you this morning, Emma, my mind has been hard at work on one subject. I am in love with you. That much you are now assured of. There is one further step to be taken to crown my present happiness. I wish to ask for your hand. Nothing in the world would stop me, but for the fear that it would attack the happiness of your father.
I cannot deny it. While my dear father lives, any change of condition must be impossible for me. I could never quit him.
I feel as strongly as yourself that you cannot quit your father, but it need not prevent any change of condition. I've been thinking it over most deeply, most intently. I had at first hoped to induce Mr. Woodhouse to remove with you to Donwell. I wanted to believe it feasible, but it would risk your father's comfort, perhaps even his life, which must not be hazarded. Mr. Woodhouse taken from Hartfield. No, it ought not to be attempted. But my second plan, dearest Emma, I trust you will not find in any respect objectionable, that I should be received at Hartfield, And so long as your father's happiness requires Hartfield to remain your home, it should be mine likewise.
Of their all removing to Donwell, Emma had already had her own passing thoughts. Like him, she had tried the scheme and rejected it, but such an alternative as this had not occurred to her. She was sensible of all the affection it evinced. She felt that in quitting Donwell, he must be sacrificing a great deal of independence of hours and habits. That, in living constantly with her father and in no house of his own, there would be much, very much, to be borne with. She promised to think of it, and advised him to think of it more. But he was fully convinced that no reflection could alter his wishes or his opinion on the subject. He had given it, he could assure her, very long and calm consideration. It is remarkable that Emma, in the many, very many, points of view in which she was now beginning to consider Donwell Abbey, was never struck with any sense of injury to her nephew Henry, whose rights as heir expectant had formerly been so tenaciously regarded. Think she must of the possible difference to the poor little boy, and yet she only gave herself a saucy, conscious smile about it, and found amusement in detecting the real cause of that violent dislike of Mr. Knightley's marrying Jane Fairfax or anybody else. This proposal of his, this plan of marrying and continuing at Hartfield, the more she contemplated it, the more pleasing it became. The evils it would cause him seemed to lessen, her own advantages to increase, their mutual good to outweigh every drawback. Such a companion for herself in the periods of anxiety and cheerlessness before her, such a partner in all those duties and cares to which time must be giving increase of melancholy. She would have been too happy but for poor Harriet. But every blessing of her own seemed to involve and advance the sufferings of her friend, who must now be even excluded from Hartfield. The delightful family party which Emma was securing for herself, poor Harriet must, in mere charitable caution, be kept at a distance from. It seemed a peculiarly cruel necessity that was to be placing her in such a state of unmerited punishment. In time, of course, Mr. Knightley would be forgotten, that is, supplanted, but this could not be expected to happen very early. Mr. Knightley himself would be doing nothing to assist the cure, not like Mr. Elton. Mr. Knightley, always so kind, so feeling, so truly considerate for everybody, would never deserve to be less worshipped than now. And it really was too much to hope, even of Harriet, that she could be in love with more than three men in 1 year. It was a very great relief to Emma to find Harriet as desirous as herself to avoid a meeting. Their intercourse was painful enough by letter. How much worse it would have been had they been obliged to meet. She had no difficulty in procuring Isabella's invitation, and she was fortunate in having a sufficient reason for asking it without resorting to invention. There was a tooth amiss, and Harriet really wished and had wished some time to consult a dentist. Mrs. John Knightley was delighted to be of use and quite eager to have Harriet under her care. Emma proposed it to her friend and found her very persuadable. Harriet was to go. She was invited for at least a fortnight. She was to be conveyed in Mr. Woodhouse's carriage. It was all arranged, it was all completed, and Harriet was safe in Brunswick Square. Now Emma could indeed enjoy Mr. Knightley's visits with true happiness, unchecked by that sense of injustice, of guilt, of something most painful, which had haunted her when remembering how disappointed her heart was near her, which she had led astray herself. She would not allow any other anxiety to succeed directly to the place in her mind which Harriet had occupied. There was a communication before her, one which she only could be competent to make, the confession of her engagement to her father. But she would have nothing to do with it at present. She had resolved to defer the disclosure till Mrs. Weston was safe and well following the birth of her child. She soon resolved, equally as a duty and a pleasure, to employ half an hour of this holiday of spirits in calling on Miss Fairfax. She ought to go, and she was longing to see her, the resemblance of their present situations increasing every other motive of goodwill. It would be a secret satisfaction. She went, but the fear of being still unwelcome determined her, though assured of their being at home, to wait in the passage and send up her name. She heard the maid announcing it, but no such bustle succeeded as poor Miss Bates had before made. No, she was invited in, and a moment afterwards she was met on the stairs by Jane herself, coming eagerly forward, as if no other reception of her were felt sufficient. Emma had never seen her look so well, so lovely, so engaging.
Miss Woodhouse, this is most kind indeed. It is impossible for me to express. I hope you will believe... Excuse me for being so entirely without words.
Emma was gratified, and would soon have shown no want of words if the sound of Mrs. Elton's voice from the sitting room had not checked her, and made it expedient to compress all her friendly and all her congratulatory sensations into a very, very earnest shake of the hand. They proceeded to the sitting room, where Mrs. Bates and Mrs. Elton were together. Miss Bates was out, which accounted for the previous tranquillity. Emma soon believed herself to penetrate Mrs. Elton's thoughts and understand why she was, like herself, in happy spirits. It was being in Miss Fairfax's confidence and fancying herself acquainted with what was still a secret to other people. Emma saw symptoms of it immediately in the expression of her face, and while paying her own compliments to Mrs. Bates and appearing to attend to the good old lady's replies, she saw her with a sort of anxious parade of mystery, fold up a letter which she had apparently been reading aloud to Miss Fairfax, and return it into the reticule by her side. Mrs. Elton gave a palpable display of significant nods and whispered asides, repeated on every possible occasion. Soon after this, Miss Bates came in, and Emma could not help being diverted by the perplexity of her first speech to herself, resulting, she supposed, from doubt of what might be said and impatience to say everything.
Thank you, dear Miss Woodhouse. You are all kindness. It is impossible to say how happy we are over dearest Jane's prospects. That is, I mean, she has charmingly recovered. Good Mr. Perry, such attention to Jane, and Mrs. Elton, so kind of you to visit.
Yes, here I am, my good friend, and I have been here so long that anywhere else I should think it necessary to apologize. But the truth is that I am waiting for my lord and master. He promised to join me here and pay his respects to you.
What? Are we to have the pleasure of a call from Mr. Elton? That would be a favour indeed, for I know gentlemen do not like morning visits, and Mr. Elton's time is so engaged.
Upon my word, it is, Miss Bates. He really is engaged from morning to night. However, he is coming, I assure you. Yes, indeed, on purpose to wait on you all. A congratulatory visit, Jane, you know. Oh, yes, quite indispensable.
Emma felt she could not do better than go home directly and relieve the party of their parade of secrecy. She was pleased, on taking leave, to find Miss Fairfax determined to attend her out of the room, to go with her even downstairs. When they reached the front door and were quite removed from the others, it gave her an opportunity, which she immediately made use of.
"It is as well, perhaps, that I did not find you alone, Miss Fairfax. Had you not been surrounded by other friends, I might have been tempted to introduce a subject, to ask questions, to speak more openly than might have been strictly correct. I feel that I should certainly have been impertinent."
"Oh, there would have been no danger. The danger would have been of my wearying you. You could not have gratified me more than by expressing an interest. Indeed, Miss Woodhouse, I am most ashamed of my conduct. I have not time for half that I could wish to say. I long to make apologies, excuses, to urge something for myself. I feel it so very due.
Oh, you are too scrupulous. Indeed you are. You owe me no apologies, and everybody to whom you might be supposed to owe them is so perfectly satisfied, so delighted even.
You are very kind, but I know what my manners were to you. So cold and artificial. I had always a part to act. It was a life of deceit. I know that I must have disgusted you.
Pray say no more. I feel that all the apologies should be on my side. Let us forgive each other at once. We must do whatever is to be done quickest, and I think our feelings will lose no time there. I hope you have pleasant accounts from Windsor.
Very.
And the next news, I suppose, will be that we are to lose you, just as I begin to know you.
As to all that, of course, nothing can be thought of yet. I am here till claimed by Colonel and Mrs. Campbell.
Nothing can be actually settled yet, perhaps, but excuse me, it must be thought of.
You are very right. It has been thought of. And I will own to you that so far as our living with Mr. Churchill at Enscombe, it is settled. There must be 3 months at least of deep mourning, but when they are over, I imagine there will be nothing more to wait for.
Thank you, thank you. This is just what I wanted to be assured of. Oh, if you knew how much I love everything that is decided and open. Goodbye, Miss Fairfax.
Goodbye, Miss Woodhouse.
In a matter of days, Mrs. Weston's friends were all made happy by her safety. And if the satisfaction of her well-doing could be increased to Emma, it was by knowing her to be the mother of a little girl. She had been decided in wishing for a Miss Weston. She would not acknowledge that it was with any view of making a match for her hereafter with either of Isabella's sons, but she was convinced that a daughter would suit both father and mother best. It would be a great comfort to Mr. Weston as he grew older, to have his fireside enlivened by the sports and the nonsense, the freaks and the fancies of a child never banished from home. As for Mrs. Weston, no one could doubt that a daughter would be most to her, and it would be quite a pity to anyone who so well knew how to teach should not have their powers in exercise again. It was a happy topic and one of playful teasing between Emma and Mr. Knightley when they spoke of the news during a morning visit at Hartfield.
Mrs. Weston has had the advantage, you know, of practicing on me.
That is, she will indulge her daughter even more than she did you, and believe that she does not indulge her at all. It will be the only difference.
That poor child. At that rate, what will become of her?
Nothing very bad. The fate of thousands. She will be disagreeable in infancy and correct herself as she grows older. I'm losing all my bitterness against spoilt children, my dearest Emma. I, who am owing all my happiness to you, would not it be horrible ingratitude in me to be severe on them?
But I had the assistance of all your endeavours to counteract the indulgence of other people. I doubt whether my own sense would have corrected me without it.
Do you? I have no doubt. Nature gave you understanding. Miss Taylor gave you principles. You must have done well. Mr. Knightley, you always called me Mr. Knightley, and from habit it has not so very formal a sound, and yet it is formal. I want you to call me something else, but I do not know what.
I remember once calling you George in one of my amiable fits about 10 years ago. I did it because I thought it would offend you, but as you made no objection, I never did it again.
And cannot you call me George now?
Impossible! I never can call you anything but Mr. Knightley. I will not promise even to call you Mr. K. But I will promise to call you once by your Christian name. I do not say when, but perhaps you may guess where. In the building in which Mr. takes Miss, for better, for worse.
There was one part of Mr. Knightley's advice which Emma wished she could have treated more openly. His attempt to save her from her willful intimacy with Harriet Smith. It was too tender a subject, however. She could not enter on it. Harriet was very seldom mentioned between them. This, on his side, might merely proceed from her not being thought of, and a suspicion from some appearances that their friendship were declining. She was aware herself that, parting under any other circumstances, they certainly should have corresponded more, and that her intelligence would not have rested, as it now almost wholly did, on Isabella's letters. Isabella sent quite as good an account of her visitor as could be expected. On her first arrival, she had thought her out of spirits, which appeared perfectly natural as there was a dentist to be consulted. But since that business had been over, she did not appear to find Harriet different from what she had known her before. Emma's comforts and hopes were most agreeably carried on by Harriet's staying longer. Her fortnight was likely to be a month at least. Mr. and Mrs. John Knightley were to come down in August, and she was invited to remain till they could bring her back. Mr. Knightley next visited with a letter not from Isabella, however, but from John. It was the answer to the communication of his intended marriage. Emma accepted it with a very eager hand, with an impatience all alive to know what he would say about it, and not at all checked by hearing that her friend was unmentioned.
He writes like a sensible man.
He is no complimenter, and though I well know him to have a most brotherly affection for you, he is far from making flourishes. I'm amused by one part of John's letter. Did you notice it? Where he says that my information did not take him wholly by surprise? He was rather in expectation of hearing something of the kind?
I believed him to mean only so far as your having some thoughts of marrying. He had no idea of me. He seems perfectly unprepared for that.
Yes, yes. But I'm amused that he should have seen so far into my feelings. What has he been judging by? I'm not conscious of any difference in my spirits or conversation that could prepare him for my marrying at this time any more than at another. But it was so, I suppose. I dare say there was a difference when I was staying with them the other day. I believe I did not play with the children quite so much as usual. I remember one evening the poor boy saying, "Uncle seems always tired now."
And yet your spirits have revived lately, I believe.
You tease me into saying what we both already know. I shall oblige. I cannot remember a happier time in my whole life.
The time was coming when the news must spread farther, and other persons' reception of it tried. As soon as Mrs. Weston was sufficiently recovered to admit Mr. Woodhouse's visits, Emma resolved first to announce it at home and then at Randall's. But how to break it to her father at last? She had bound herself to do it in an hour of Mr. Knightley's absence, or when it came to the point her heart would have failed her and she must have put it off. Mr. Knightley was to come a short time after the appointed hour and follow up the beginning she was to make. The hour arrived. Emma was forced to speak to her father, and to speak cheerfully too. She must not appear to think it a misfortune.
You must prepare yourself, Papa, to hear something strange.
I shall attempt it, my dear. Strange in what manner?
It will be a great surprise to you. If you grant your consent, Mr. Knightley and I mean to marry and live together at Hartfield, that I may still be near you.
Marry? But, my dear, you said you would never marry.
I did, Papa, but Mr. Knightley has undone my resolve.
You are in love with each other?
Yes, Papa, completely. It was jealousy that made us realise it. For him, it was the prospect of Frank Churchill's affections, and for me, it was Mr. Knightley's admiration of Jane Fairfax.
But you said you would never marry. It would be a great deal better for you to remain single. Think of poor Isabella and poor Miss Taylor.
You must not class me with Isabella and Mrs. Weston. Their marriages took them from Hartfield and had indeed made a melancholy change. But I am not going from Hartfield. I shall be always here. I am introducing no change in our numbers or our comforts, but for the better. I am very sure that you will be a great deal the happier for having Mr. Knightley always at hand, once you have got used to the idea. Do you not love Mr. Knightley very much? Whom do you ever want to consult on business but Mr. Knightley? He is so useful to you, ready to write your letters, so cheerful, so attentive, so attached to you. Would not you like to have him always on the spot?
Yes, that is all very true. Mr. Knightley cannot be here too often. I should be glad to see him every day. But we see him every day as it is. Why could not you and he go on as you have done?
Because we are in love, Papa. We are attached to one another most sincerely, and there is no undoing it. Mr. Knightley shall visit soon to tell you more of the plans. It was his idea to stay at Hartfield for your comfort. There shall be no material change.
Oh, poor Emma.
Mr. Woodhouse could not be soon reconciled, but the worst was overcome. The idea was given. Time and continual repetition must do the rest. They had all the assistance which Isabella could give by letters of the strongest approval, and Mrs. Weston was ready on the first meeting to consider the subject in the most serviceable light. It was agreed upon as what was to be. Mr. Woodhouse was assured by all that it would be for his happiness, and having some feelings himself, which almost admitted it, he began to think that some time or other, in another year or two perhaps, it might not be so very bad if the marriage did take place. The news was universally a surprise wherever it spread, and Mr. Weston had his 5 minutes' share of it. But 5 minutes were enough to familiarize the idea to his quickness of mind. He saw the advantages of the match and rejoiced in them with all the constancy of his wife. He went to Highbury the next morning and told Jane Fairfax the news. Was she not like a daughter, his eldest daughter? He must tell her, and Miss Bates being present, it passed, of course, to Mrs. Cole, Mrs. Perry, and Mrs. Elton immediately afterwards. It was no more than the principals were prepared for. They had calculated, from the time of its being known at Randall's, how soon it would be over Highbury, and they were thinking of themselves as the evening wonder in many a family circle with great sagacity. In general, it was a very well-approved match. Some might think him, and others might think her, the most in luck. There was no serious objection raised, except in one habitation, the vicarage. There, the surprise was not softened by any satisfaction. Mr. Elton cared little about it, compared with his wife. He only hoped the young lady's pride would now be contented. But Mrs. Elton was very much discomposed indeed. She was extremely concerned, for though very eccentric, Knightley had 1,000 good qualities. Poor Knightley! How could he be so taken in? She did not think him at all in love, not in the least. How happy he had been to come and dine with them whenever they asked him. But that would be all over now. No more exploring parties to Donwell made for Mrs. Elton. There would be a Mrs. Knightley to throw cold water on everything. Extremely disagreeable. As for living together, it was a shocking plan. It would never do. She knew a family near Maple Grove who had tried it and been obliged to separate before the end of the first quarter. Time passed on. A few more tomorrows, and the party from London would be arriving. It was an alarming change, and Emma was thinking of it one morning with a book lying unread on her lap, when Mr. Knightley came in and distressing thoughts were put by. After the first chat of pleasure, he was silent, and when he spoke again, it was in a graver tone.
I have something to tell you, Emma. Some news.
Good or bad?
I do not know which it ought to be called.
Oh, good, I am sure. I see it in your countenance. You are trying not to smile.
I am very much afraid, my dear Emma, that you will not smile when you hear it.
Indeed. But why so? I can hardly imagine that anything which pleases or amuses you should not please and amuse me too.
There is one subject, I hope but one, on which we do not think alike. Does nothing occur to you? Do you not recollect? Harriet Smith. She is to marry Robert Martin.
Oh, can it be possible?
It is so indeed. I have it from Robert Martin himself. He left me not half an hour ago. By your looks, you like it, my Emma, as little as I fear.
You mistake me. You quite mistake me. It is not that such a circumstance would now make me unhappy, but that I cannot believe it. It seems an impossibility. You cannot mean to say that Harriet Smith has accepted Robert Martin. You cannot mean that he has even proposed to her again. You only mean that he intends it.
I mean that he has done it and been accepted.
Good God! Well, Now tell me everything. Make this intelligible to me. How, where, when? Let me know it all.
It is a very simple story. He went to town on business 3 days ago, and I got him to take charge of some papers which I was wanting to send to John. He delivered these papers to John at his chambers and was asked by him to join their party the same evening to Astley's. The party was to be Isabella and John and Miss Smith. My friend Robert could not resist. In the course of that visit, as I understand, he found an opportunity of speaking to Harriet, and certainly did not speak in vain. She made him, by her acceptance, as happy even as he is deserving. He came down by yesterday's coach and was with me this morning, immediately after breakfast, to report his proceedings, first on my affairs and then on his own. This is all that I can relate of the how, where, and when. Your friend Harriet will make a much longer history when you see her. However, I must say that Robert Martin's heart seemed very overflowing. Emma, my love, I'm afraid the situation gives you more pain than you expected. I will answer for your thinking better and better of him as you know him more. His good sense and good principles would delight you. As far as the man is concerned, you could not wish your friend in better hands.
You need not be at any pains to reconcile me to the match. I think Harriet is doing extremely well. Her connections may be worse than his. In respectability of character, there can be no doubt that they are. I have been silent from surprise merely, excessive surprise.
You are materially changed since we talked on this subject before.
I hope so, for at that time I was a fool.
And I am changed also, for I am now very willing to grant you all Harriet's good qualities. I've taken some pains to get acquainted with her, both for your sake and for Robert Martin's sake, who I always believed to be as much in love with her as ever. I've talked to Harriet a good deal. You must have seen that I did. Sometimes, indeed, I've thought you were half suspecting me of pleading poor Martin's cause, which was never the case. But from all my observations, I am convinced of her being an artless, amiable girl, with very good notions. Much of this, I have no doubt, she may thank you for.
Me? Poor Harriet.
Their conversation was soon afterwards closed by the entrance of her father. She was not sorry. She wanted to be alone. Her father's business was to announce James's being gone out to put the horses to, preparatory to their now daily drive to Randall's, and she had, therefore, an immediate excuse for disappearing. Her mind was in a state of flutter and wonder, which made it impossible for her to be collected. She was in dancing, singing, exclaiming spirits. Until she had moved about and talked to herself and laughed and reflected, she could be fit for nothing rational. The joy, the gratitude, the exquisite delight of her sensations may be imagined. The sole grievance thus removed in the prospect of Harriet's welfare, she was really in danger of becoming too happy for security. What had she to wish for? Nothing but to grow more worthy of Mr. Knightley, whose intentions and judgment had been ever so superior to her own. Nothing but that the lessons of her past folly might teach her humility and circumspection in future. In the gayest and happiest spirits, she set forward with her father, not always listening but always agreeing to what he said. They arrived. Mrs. Weston was alone in the drawing-room. But hardly had they been shown in when she caught a glimpse, through the blind, of two figures passing near the window.
It is Frank and Miss Fairfax. I was just going to tell you of our agreeable surprise in seeing him arrive this morning. He stays till tomorrow, and Miss Fairfax has been persuaded to spend the day with us. They are coming in, I hope.
In half a minute they were in the room. Emma was extremely glad to see Frank Churchill again. But there was a degree of confusion, a number of embarrassing recollections on each side. They met readily and smiling, but with a consciousness which at first allowed little to be said. When Mr. Weston joined the party, however, and when the baby was fetched, there was no longer a want of subject or animation, or of courage and opportunity, for Frank Churchill to draw near her and speak in confidence.
I have to thank you, Miss Woodhouse, for a very kind, forgiving message in one of Mrs. Weston's letters. I hope time has not made you less willing to pardon me. I hope you do not retract what you then said.
No, indeed, not in the least. I'm particularly glad to see and shake hands with you, and to give you joy in person.
I thank you with all my heart. Is not Miss Fairfax looking well? Better than she ever used to do? You see how my father and Mrs. Weston dote upon her. Oh, by the by, I hope Mr. Knightley is well. I know you saw my letter and think you may remember my wish in your favour. Let me return your congratulations. I assure you that I have heard the news with the warmest interest and satisfaction. He is a man whom I cannot presume to praise. I really do believe I have never seen such a skin as Miss Fairfax possesses. Such smoothness, such delicacy, and yet without being actually fair. A most distinguishing complexion. Just colour enough for beauty.
I have always admired her complexion, but do not I remember the time when you found fault with her for being so pale?
What an impudent dog I was. How could I dare?
I do suspect that in the midst of your perplexities at that time, you had very great amusement in tricking us all. Perhaps I am the readier to suspect because, to tell you the truth, I think it might have been some amusement to myself in the same situation. I think there is a little likeness between us.
He bowed, and Emma smiled archly in return. The others had been talking of the child, Mrs. Weston giving an account of a little alarm she had been under the evening before from the infant's appearing not quite well. She believed she had been foolish, but it had alarmed her, and she had been within half a minute of sending for Mr. Perry. Frank Churchill caught the name and spoke to Emma while trying to catch Miss Fairfax's eye.
Perry. My friend Mr. Perry. What are they saying about Mr. Perry? Has he been here this morning? And how does he travel now? Has he set up his carriage?
Emma soon recollected and understood him, and while she joined in the laugh, it was evident from Jane's countenance that she too was really hearing him, though trying to seem deaf.
Such an extraordinary dream of mine. I can never think of it without laughing. She hears us. She hears us, Miss Woodhouse. I see it in her cheek, her smile, her vain attempt to frown. Look at her. Do not you see that at this instant the very passage of her own letter which sent me the report is passing under her eye, that whole blunder is spread before her, that she can attend to nothing else, though pretending to listen to the others? Ah, now she turns.
How you can bear such recollections is astonishing to me. They will sometimes obtrude, but how you can court them?
He had a great deal to say in return, and very entertainingly. But Emma's feelings were chiefly with Jane in the argument, and on leaving Randall's and falling naturally into a comparison of the two men, she felt that, pleased as she had been to see Frank Churchill, and really regarding him as she did, with friendship, she had never been more sensible of Mr. Knightley's high superiority of character. It was this contemplation which completed the happiness of this most happy day. A very few days more brought the party from London, and Emma had no sooner an opportunity of being 1 hour alone with Harriet than she became perfectly satisfied, unaccountable as it was, that Robert Martin had thoroughly supplanted Mr. Knightley and was now forming all her views of happiness. Harriet was a little distressed, but having once owned that she had been presumptuous and silly and self-deceived before, her pain and confusion seemed to die away with the words. Once she received her friend's most unqualified congratulations, she had not a care for the past and only the fullest exultation in the present and future. The particulars of the engagement, which Harriet delighted in sharing, proved to Emma that Harriet had always liked Robert Martin, and that his continuing to love her had been irresistible. Beyond this, it must ever be unintelligible to Emma. The evening of their engagement, however, was most joyful, and every day was giving her fresh reason for thinking so, most especially when Harriet's parentage became known. She proved to be the daughter of a tradesman, rich enough to afford her the comfortable maintenance which had ever been hers, and decent enough to have always wished for concealment. Such was the blood of gentility which Emma had formerly been so ready to vouch for. What a connection had she been preparing for Mr. Knightley, or for the Churchills, or even for Mr. Elton? The stain of illegitimacy, unbleached by nobility or wealth, would have been a stain indeed. Harriet, necessarily drawn away by her engagements with the Martins, was less and less at Hartfield, which was not to be regretted. The intimacy between her and Emma must sink. Their friendship must change into a calmer sort of goodwill. It seemed already beginning, and in the most gradual, natural manner. Before the end of September, Emma attended Harriet to church and saw her hand bestowed on Robert Martin with so complete a satisfaction as no remembrances, even connected with Mr. Elton as he stood before them, could impair. Robert Martin and Harriet Smith, the latest couple engaged of the three, were the first to be married. Jane Fairfax had already quitted Highbury and was restored to the comforts of her beloved home with the Campbells. The Mr. Churchills were also in town, and they were only waiting for November, when the mourning period would be over and the wedding could go ahead. The intermediate month was the one fixed on, as far as they dared, by Emma and Mr. Knightley. They had determined that their marriage ought to be concluded while John and Isabella were still at Hartfield. The only difficulty lay with Mr. Woodhouse, who had never yet alluded to their marriage but as a distant event. With a little time, however, he began to become resigned to a wedding that would take place in a matter of weeks. Still, however, he was not happy. Nay, he appeared so much otherwise that his daughter's courage failed. She hesitated. She could not proceed. In this state of suspense, they were befriended not by any sudden illumination of Mr. Woodhouse's mind or any wonderful change of his nervous system, but by the operation of the same system in another way. Mrs. Weston's poultry house was robbed one night of all her turkeys. Other poultry yards in the neighbourhood also suffered. Pilfering was housebreaking to Mr. Woodhouse's fears. He was very uneasy, and but for the sense of his son-in-law's protection, would have been under wretched alarm every night of his life. The strength, resolution, and presence of mind of the Mr. Knightleys commanded his fullest dependence. While either of them protected him and his, Hartfield was safe. But Mr. John Knightley must be in London again by the end of the first week in November. The result of this distress was that, with a much more voluntary, cheerful consent than his daughter had ever presumed to hope for, she was able to fix her wedding day. And Mr. Elton was called on within a month from the marriage of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Martin to join the hands of Mr. Knightley and Miss Woodhouse. The wedding was very much like other weddings where the parties have no taste for finery or parade. Mrs. Elton, from the particulars detailed by her husband, thought it all extremely shabby and very inferior to her own, but she was alone in finding deficiencies. The small band of true friends who witnessed the ceremony could wish for nothing more, and found their wishes and hopes were fully answered in the perfect happiness of the union.
You have been listening to Emma by Jane Austen, an Audible Studios production for Audible Originals, directed by Catherine Thompson, dramatized for audio by Anna Lee, with Emma Thompson as the narrator. Isabella Inchbold played Emma Woodhouse and Joseph Milson played George Knightley. Also featuring Alexa Davis as Harriet Smith, Joanne Froggatt as Mrs. Weston, Adam Gillan as Mr. Elton, Rupert Holiday Evans as Mr. Woodhouse, Aisling Loftus as Augusta Elton. Angela McIntosh as Mrs. Cole and Mrs. Ford. Ukwali Roach as John Knightley. Morgana Robinson as Miss Bates. Nicholas Rowe as Mr. Weston. Benjamin Wainwright as Frank Churchill. Eve Webster as Isabella Knightley. And Ria Zmitrovich as Jane Fairfax. Vocal edit by Alex Barton. Music and sound design by Stephen Jones. The assistant director was Anna Lee. The production was engineered by Joe Richardson. Casting led by Katie Arlett for Audible Studios. Production coordinators were Imogen Papworth, Yuki Palmer, Marielle Runacre-Temple and Nicola Wall. The runner was Charlotte Harris. Executive producer, Katie Arlett. Commissioning editor, Rebecca Fenton for Audible Originals. Please visit audible.co.uk to enjoy more audio dramas from Audible Originals.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.